org. Lows tonight in the upper 50s with possible fog and fog probable in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs near 81.
Hello, I'm Catherine Cullen.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Texas, hold on to them. Democratic lawmakers who left the state in an effort to block the passage of a Republican gerrymandering effort are back. And now they're living under round-the-clock police surveillance to ensure they don't leave again before the next vote. One state rep tells us the situation is absurd and more than a little awkward.
And it may look quite a lot like a big wet rat. And it may in many ways be quite a lot like a big wet rat, but a water rodent called a rockaly is being celebrated as the winner of a nationwide underrated animal contest in Australia.
Those stories and more coming up on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here on KAXE. And coming up at 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. Support comes from Clacko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer, as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More at clackobrewing.com. We also thank Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And we invite you to join us for Grand Rapids River Fest Saturday, September 6th at the Grand Rapids Area Library Amphitheater right next door to KAXE. You can find your tickets and information about the artists and lots of information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. We're going to hear a song now from Margo Price from her 2020 album, That's How Rumors Get Started. This one's called Letting Me Down.
Paid back and left a hole in this town. They don't make them like
That is Margot Price. She will be part of this year's Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th. She'll be joined by Courtney Barnett, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find your tickets and more information at grandrapidsriverfest.com. I'm Jennifer Barr. There will be more ahead from As It Happens here in a few moments on KAXC. Some other live music in the area. Ted Fader is playing this Thursday evening at Roundhouse Brewery in Nisswa starting at 5 o'clock. And Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest begins on Friday. That's happening just 1 mile north of Itasca State Park. That features Forge North and many more. Thanks for listening to KAXC. We continue now with As It Happens on People Powered Radio.
Hello, I'm Catherine Cullen, sitting in for Neil Cooksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Tough calls. A Newfoundland man is waiting by the phone to find out if his family home has been destroyed by wildfire and supporting his neighbors who've already received bad news.
Many unhappy returns. She's back home after fleeing to delay a Republican redistricting move, but now a Texas Democrat is living under police surveillance and is not allowed to leave the state.
Seriously? Don't go chasing waterfalls. We'll hear about the dramatic rescue of a climber who was rappelling in a California canyon but wound up trapped behind a powerful waterfall.
Putting the spanking in brand spanking new, MSNBC is becoming MS Now, but the team responsible for the rebrand is getting reprimanded because they didn't dot their I's, cross their T's, or reserve their URLs.
Putting the diver in biodiversity, Australia holds a vote to determine the country's most underrated animal, and the tale of the swimming rodent that won is a real underdog story. Well, under rat story.
And mobile apps. A historic church in Sweden is being relocated very, very slowly to a new home. A local official tells us the journey is challenging, both technically and emotionally. As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that knows when you're moving a locked church, you've got to mind your keys and pews. In Newfoundland tonight, a lot of people are waiting by the phone, but hoping it doesn't ring. Officials are calling people whose homes and properties have been destroyed by a wildfire that's been raging for weeks. The Kingston Fire in Conception Bay North has destroyed 203 structures, and that number is expected to go up. Meanwhile, the fire itself is still growing, reaching an area of over 10,000 hectares. Barry Snow's family home was in the line of fire, but he has no idea whether it survived. We reached him in St. John's.
Barry, what has it been like day after day waiting for a phone call to find out whether this family property has made it?
Really, it's been hour by hour by hour, and it's had its high points, you know, where we were very optimistic. It's had its low points where we were on the floor. And absolutely everything in between. Our little situation aside, we're finding that it's the cumulative effect of it all, really, that's having the most profound impact on us, probably.
The cumulative effect of the stress or of the community? What do you mean?
The community. You know, our situation is not unique. There are thousands, you know, of people in a similar boat. People that we know, people that, you know, are friends, relatives, people we love. It's not our personal terror that we're going through. It's a group thing. We're finding that's hitting us pretty hard, too.
Hard seeing so many people that you care so much about struggling so much all at the same time.
100%. And these are people that have been in my life, my whole life. Some of them may not return to the shore. Some of them will be displaced. Some have, you know, as we speak, some have absolutely no idea where they'll be tomorrow afternoon.
In your case, this is a property that's not your principal residence, but it's been in your family for a long time. Can you give me a sense of what it means to your family?
I'm in my mid-60s now. I never use the term owner. I'm merely this generation's custodian of that place, which has been in our family continuously for over 200 years, dating back to permanent settlement on that shore. The property itself is large, on the ocean's edge, populated by rock walls and gardens and hay gardens and potato gardens, and our family fished from there for forever. The old house that still stands today was purchased by my great-grandparents in 1911. So, my mother was born in the house, her father, his siblings, my mother's siblings, my great-grandparents, they all would have died in the house. They would have been waked in the house, funerals from the house, all of that sort of family history. And
so much family history.
And lore.
Let me ask you, Barry, you were last there about 2.5 weeks ago, I understand. When you left, did you know that the property might be in jeopardy?
We did, yeah. Monday, my wife and I packed up. Didn't really realize the scope of what was happening until we got back to St. John's, looked at the phone and came to the realization of what was happening. So we drove down to a little community not far from St. John's here that has a full view of the bay and across the bay towards our place. And the flames of hell were right in front of our eyes. It was Armageddon. We realized then the scope of things, I suppose. We returned to the house. We collected whatever we could. Had those conversations in the kitchen about do we take this, do we take that. We walked around every corner of the property, and we gave each other a little kiss in the kitchen, and locked it up and drove away.
As you said, we don't know what's happened to this property, but you have heard from family, friends, folks who live in the area. The Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, John Hogan, flew over Conception Bay this week to survey the damage, and he said the province will be there to rebuild. What would you like that support to look like for your community?
You know what? That hasn't been the focus in my mind. In my heart, I want to believe it and all that sort of stuff, but that's not where our immediate attention has been. I know that all of the things, all of the vistas, all of the houses that I knew, as a boy, as an adult, and so on, that I've looked at all my life, many are gone. So the place will never be the same again, never, under any circumstances, rebuilding or not. And I haven't been focusing on what that might look like.
Barry, if the property does survive, you get to walk back through that door again. What's the first thing you're going to do?
Before that, we'll have to summon a lot of courage to put ourselves in front of that place again, to eyeball it. And the short answer is I have no idea. I don't know the answer to that question until I kind of survey everything around me, what's there, what's left, what's not. I do know that it's going to be overwhelming. It's going to, require a lot of guts, but no more guts than what people on the, people on the ground have been experiencing for the last 2 weeks, and people that I know and relatives and so on. Right now we're in limbo until we really find out what the situation is.
Barry, I wish you and your family and everyone who is being affected by these fires all the best.
Thank you. Take care.
We reached Barry Snow in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. The evacuees and first responders are dealing with a lot right now, but at least they don't have to do it on an empty stomach. Jerry Joy owns two Indian Express restaurants in Newfoundland where he's been offering free meals to those affected by the fires, but it dawned on him that perhaps not everyone is a fan of Indian food. So on Sunday, he whipped up a traditional Newfoundland jigs dinner. Actually, 175 jigs dinners. Here's Mr. Joy speaking to Jen White, host of the St. John's Morning Show.
It went very well. A lot of people came together to help. I couldn't have done it without them. And we started with 100 jigs in mind, but we felt that there might be a need for more, and somehow ended up cooking for 175 jigs.
Oh my goodness, 175?
175, yes.
What was it like cooking all of those meals, all that jigs?
Oh, this morning I put a post, you know, somebody told me, you know, jigs is throwing things together and boiling, and they lied to me. That was a lot of work. So I posted, you know, next time your mom cooks jigs and you don't, before getting up from the table, said, thank you, Mama, that was delicious. I'm going to track you down and whoop your
So was this your first time cooking jigs?
Mine, yes. My wife cooks a good jigs dinner. She's an expert at it, so... But I didn't have a clue how to do it.
How did it make you feel to be able to do this for the community?
It's a great feeling. You know, it's only when you do it, you realize, wow, this makes you feel better. And the people coming together, they are in high spirits, and people who are affected. And, you know, I only get to see it from my social media in Facebook. I can see how it has lifted the spirits, right, of people. So I think that is exactly what we wanted now, and I'm so happy. I mean, I was able to do a little, contribute a little bit towards it.
That was Jerry Joy, a Newfoundland restaurant owner who made 175 jigs dinners on Sunday for people affected by the wildfires. He was talking to the CBC's Jen White. It's a rust-red color, is more than 113 years old, and it weighs over 600 tons, and it's moving. The people of Kiruna, Sweden, love their church, so much so that they've decided to pick it up and transport the whole 113-year-old 600-ton thing to a new location. It's part of a major plan to move the whole town before it's swallowed by a nearby mine. Today, the historic building began to roll through the streets. Clara Nyström is the Municipal Heritage Officer for the City of Kiruna.
Clara, where is the church now?
So the church is about halfway to a new place. So it's about an area called Lombolo. You really see this spot from a lot of places in Kiruna. So yeah, it's standing still for tonight.
So it's just sort of like parked in the middle of the road overnight?
Yes, it is. So the church will, yeah, stay there for tonight, sleep there and rest.
It is, as we were saying, massive. How exactly is it being moved? Can you kind of paint a picture for us?
Yeah, so it is big. And the first question was, can we move it in one piece, or should we like divide it in pieces? And they saw that, okay, we can move them one piece, but then which way will it go? It is so wide. So they did a new road for it, and then they like dig out the foundation, mm-hmm. and then put in some trailers. So there's two trailers, then it's like a joystick, so it's driven by a joystick. One man is having the joystick and driving.
And that's what moves it forward. And you had to get, I am certainly not going to use the right technical terms here. This is not my area of expertise, but all these wheels underneath to move it along the road. It's an enormous undertaking.
It is. And I think it's more than 200 wheels. And I think that every wheel can, if it has to, can move separately also.
Wow. Now, this thing is not, because it is so big, moving at warp speed exactly. When the man running the joystick really gets it going, how fast are we talking here?
Yeah, not fast. It feels very slowly. It is half kilometers per hour. So you can really walk along. And there's a lot of people that is walking along.
Yeah, tell me a bit about what this has been like in the community. I've seen some images. People have been crowding around watching this happen.
So the start was at 8:00. There was a lot of people there. I don't know how many, but beforehand they said that maybe 10,000 people would watch. So, of course, it's a huge thing for Kiruna, and also it's quite emotional, of course. Everyone has a connection to the church. Now it is moving. So both joy, it's a cool thing that is happening, but of course also emotional. Now it's leaving old Kiruna behind.
Something a bit sad about it.
Yeah.
What does the church mean to you? You said everyone has an emotional connection. What's yours?
Well, it is. Of course, I work with cultural heritage. Of course, it's really important for that matter. But also, my daughter is baptized there. I've been there on every occasion for funerals and weddings. And most of all, I like to be in there alone inside. I think that just walking towards the church, it's quite high up. And then you walk in and you have this smell, wood. Smell that is just the feeling of the church. I love it.
What did it feel like when you saw it finally start to move?
Well, at the beginning, I was okay, I'm not feeling so much. I was more, I talked to my colleagues, is it moving? Because at the start, it was so slowly. And I was walking behind the church, so I saw the back of the church. But a few hours later, I was instead ahead of the church, waiting for it to come. And the front of the church was approaching. I saw the mine, and I saw the church, and the sun was shining towards the church, and it's so beautiful. And then it really hit me. It is something very emotional. And then a lot of emotions came.
You mentioned seeing the mine, and of course the church is being moved because of the mine expansion. Mm. How do you feel about that trade-off?
Of course, that is also a big topic, that the inhabitants of Kiruna have to sacrifice so much. Our built-in heritage, our memories, many houses where you live. So, of course, that is something. We sacrifice our city, and of course, we're getting a new city, but we leave it behind for the sake of the state.
You must have thought many times about what it will be like to step inside it once it has found its new home.
Really, I have. And I think just this smell will be the same, but also, of course, the church will open up in about 2 years, I think. But I have a hard time seeing that the new park around it, because it would be a little bit a forest. So we have to plant a lot of trees, and also Kiruna is where we are in the Arctic, so the trees is growing very, very slowly. So I think also it will take time for it to feel quite okay, now it's finished.
It will take time for the broader process of moving, Kiruna. I understand it's about 2035 that the process is supposed to be done. And so in closing, what is your hope for this new community, this new beginning of sorts?
I feel that the history now, when it's so... because I could really feel the history inside of Kiruna, the old Kiruna. And I hope that we can try to bring that along. So you see this movement of buildings, and of course we have a new city center, and also that the buildings that are built, most buildings are newly built. And I also hope that they are built in such a way with great architectural. So in the future, we can see that, okay, New Kiruna is something also spectacular and has a great value.
Clara, it's an incredibly busy time for you, an extraordinary event. Thank you for making time to talk to us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Clara Nyström is the Municipal Heritage Officer for the city of Kiruna. We reached her in Kiruna, Sweden. To some extent, most elections are a popularity contest. No amount of experience or good intentions or intriguing policy will get you very far without at least some kind of name recognition. So there's something about a popular vote for the most underrated animal that's kind of incongruous. I mean, if you're chosen as most underrated, aren't you no longer underrated, but possibly overrated or at least rated? I don't know, but I do know this. A water rat is the unlikely winner of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's underrated animal contest. Or maybe the likely winner. Nothing makes sense anymore. Jacinda Bowler is an ABC science reporter who helped run the competition that saw the Rakali come out on top. We reached them in Melbourne.
Jacinda, what the heck is a Rakali?
The Rakali is a rodent. It's a big water rat. It kind of fills the same niche as an otter does. But if you look at the photos of this thing, it is definitely a rat. They went through a rebrand in the early 90s. They were just called the water rat, but they now are called the Rakali. That's an Aboriginal name. And there's actually so many different Aboriginal names for them because they're found all around Australia. They're very well suited to the Australian ecosystem.
Okay, before we spend more time with our friends, the water rats, let's take a step back. Where did the idea for an underrated animal contest come from?
Yeah, so we wanted to try and get a group of animals that people don't think of as iconically Australian animals. You know, you've got your big ones, you've got the koala, the kangaroo, but there's just so many other Australian animals that we don't think of as iconic. And so we wanted to try and get those animals a bit more spotlight. And I think, I mean, we've had 65,000 votes. There's animals on there like the turtle frog or the velvet worm that even Australians like would not have known about before this competition. And now they're out there in the world, which is really cool.
And there is some controversy here, and not necessarily because the water rat won, but rather the decision to exclude the ibis. Tell me about this.
Oh, yes. So we didn't include the ibis. It's one of Australia's very iconic animals. We like to call it the bin chicken, very similar to a raccoon, I imagine. But we wanted to include animals that people either didn't know about or didn't know enough about. And the ibis, as amazing as it is, and, you know, in some areas not very well liked, is not one of those animals, in my opinion. It is rated whether or not you love it or hate it.
So I guess it is difficult by definition to predict the outcome of an effort to find the most underrated anything. But to what extent were you surprised when the Rakali came out on top?
When we were first creating the list, I definitely wouldn't have thought the Rakali would have been a winner. People like it, but it's not one of those animals that you think of as super charismatic. But the Rakali, I mean, it is found around Australia, and I think it's one of the animals that people either kind of know about, maybe know a little bit about and think it's really cool, or don't know about it all and read about it and find out that, you know, it kills cane toads and it does all this other stuff and go, that's the one I want to vote for. That's the best one. Well,
and this is what I want you to help me out with. Now, I didn't know anything about most of these animals before we started, but I want folks to understand what the water rat beat out. There are palm cockatoos, which have like these sort of punk rock black mohawk of feathers. They drum using seed pods and sticks. The turtle frog looks like a tiny little bodybuilder, has a pasty white body with big arms and a teeny head. The giant cuttlefish can grow up to a meter long. It is the world's largest cuttlefish species, and it can also disappear into a puff of ink and mucus. How did a water rat beat out all those other fascinating animals?
Yeah, I mean, the cuttlefish is a really interesting one, actually, because we, at the moment, there's an algae bloom happening in South Australia. So there's a lot of worry around the cuttlefish. So the cuttlefish would have been a very good option. But the people, yeah, they like the Roccali. But the Roccali is great, you know. It's got this little white tip on its tail. It's got a golden bellied fur. It loves to eat all kinds of different animals, whether it's, you know, shellfish, fish, or, you know, a bird that gets too close to an edge. It's kind of like the lesser known cousin of a platypus.
I do wonder also about winning a most underrated animal competition. then can you still be the most underrated, or should it be the short-finned eel, which got the fewest votes, that is in fact objectively the most underrated animal?
We've been joking about that. If we do this again next year, I think the eel is going to have to be one of the competitors, and then we'll have to find 9 other more underrated animals. I think the Roccali winning the competition means that it is absolutely an icon and can no longer be classed as underrated, even though it has won the most underrated animal contest.
Now, our listeners may remember this, but we had a considerable number of conversations on this show about a similar competition that was run by the editors of The Guardian earlier this year in search of an overlooked invertebrate specifically. Here's what one of their editors, Bibi van der Zee, told us after the tardigrade came out on top.
The head of news did ask me how I was feeling when it all finished, and I admitted I was, you know, life was opening emptily ahead of me with that invertebrate of the year, but I'm sure I'll come up with something. It has changed the way I see the world, definitely, doing this. I found myself picking a worm up off the pavement that had got stranded and putting it in a nearby flower bed. So I think, yeah, it does make you see things a bit differently.
Were you as moved by your own competition? Do you see the world differently now?
Yeah, I feel like my head is absolutely filled to the brim with facts about all 10 of these animals. I love the turtle frog and the velvet worm, but I think all of them have just, yeah, they've wormed their way into my heart. I see what you did there. I am incredibly jazzed about all of these animals, and I think they're good. I think I'm most sad about the eel because, yeah, coming last in this competition is rough, I think, but it's just wonderful that we've got to do this and that people, I mean, know more about all of these wonderful, wonderful animals that, I mean, until a couple of weeks ago, they probably didn't know existed, which is, yeah, really great.
Well, it's not just the water rat that's in the spotlight, but your competition, right? National news, 65,000 votes. What are you going to do next?
I don't know, actually. So we do these kind of competitions every year. We've done ones before, like favorite animal sounds, favorite trees. The underrated animals has been extremely popular. So whether we decide to do underrated animals part 2 next year or something else entirely, I don't know. But
you don't want to find out, though, that the underrated animal competition is overrated if you keep going that, seems that way.
That's true. Maybe we should quit while we're ahead.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thank you.
Jacinda Bowler is a science reporter who helped run the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Underrated Animal Contest. We reached them in Melbourne. Now here's Megan Patrick with Underrated.
He's a B-side, never got to the radio, but it makes you feel something real coming through your stereo. He's your first truck, yeah, the one you saved up for. A little rust ain't worth much, but it was all yours. He's a steady hand, he's a hidden gem. Never thought I'd fall for him.
Patrick with Underrated.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a Texas Democrat tells us what it's like for her and colleagues to be tailed by police everywhere they go now that they're back in the state after fleeing to try to block a Republican redistricting bill.
And URL be sorry. Does that? Yeah. In the no doubt exhaustive reviews that took place before the new MSNBC rebrand, someone forgot to check the URL for MS Now wasn't already taken. Which, of course, it is. But now that snow removal company is poised to make off with truckloads.
Stay tuned. I'm Catherine Cullen.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. And at 10 o'clock, Malachi Coons has more great music on Headwaters. Partly cloudy tonight, possible fog, lows in the upper 50s, and tomorrow, dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs near 81. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85, slight chance for afternoon showers in the Bemidji area, then cooling down into the mid-70s by Friday, mid-60s by Saturday. There is a local drive for the National Marrow Donor Program this Friday from 11 to 2 and again 5 to 7 at the Grand Rapids Dairy Queen. Healthy individuals ages 18 to 35 can get their cheek swabbed at the event and register to possibly save a life. You can also join the registry by texting Cure Cancer Today without spaces to 61474.
Texas Democratic lawmakers are back home after spending the last couple of weeks outside the state in an effort to block or delay passage of a Republican gerrymandering effort that would likely deliver 5 congressional districts into GOP hands. And after the Democrats came back, they were compelled to sign a document agreeing to around-the-clock police surveillance if they left the state house. One rep, Nicole Collier, has refused to sign and has been on the state house floor since yesterday.
I refuse. I've just had enough. I've had enough of this bullying tactics. They just continue to bully us and run over us. I've just had enough. I just said, why would I agree to this? Why do I have to continue to be subject to their control?
Texas Democrat Nicole Collier speaking from the floor of the state legislature after waking up there early this morning. 2 weeks ago, we spoke to State Representative Vicki Goodwin while she was in Chicago. We reached her again today in Austin.
Representative Goodwin, how does it feel to be back home in Texas?
I mean, it's good to be home. I miss my husband and my home, so that's great. It was not a good feeling to walk onto the House floor, however.
Well, and before you left, you had to sign this permission slip of sorts, agree to some restrictions. Tell me what that means for you.
Yeah, you know, a little bit awkward. We have to have a DPS person following us day and night to make sure that we get
back. DPS, that's state security, state police?
That's correct, mm-hmm. Right. Department of Public Safety. So every member that had been on the quorum break that returned yesterday had to sign this permission slip. You know, I honestly didn't even think about the idea of not signing it. I had an appointment I needed to get to, and so signed it. And this person has been following me ever since. You know, he actually said to me that he just about apologized and said, you know, this isn't our choice, but we have to do it.
Following you everywhere. I mean, how intensive are we talking here? Like, brought you to your home? Like, what, like, follows you all the way to the washroom? What does this mean?
Well, followed me home, and he's sitting in his car outside my home. He's not visible when we look out our front windows, but he's there, and as soon as I pull out of my driveway, he pulls out behind me and follows me wherever I go. So, you know, again, a little bit awkward. I had a dermatology appointment, so going to the doctor, that, you know, a little intrusive to have somebody follow you to your doctor's office. But he doesn't come in. He just sits in his car. And the whole point of it is they want to make sure that we return to the House floor Wednesday morning so that we can vote on this map, which we know is going to be brought to the floor on Wednesday. And if it were possible for us to continue our quorum break, we certainly would have. And so it's not a good feeling to be back and be forced to vote on something that we strongly believe is detrimental, not just to Texas, but detrimental to our democracy.
You say if it were possible. I mean, what was it that made you decide that you could come back and not just stay away?
You know, we looked at the reality. We would have had to have stayed away for months. But even if it was only November or December, you're talking about months of members not being at home, not being with their families, not doing their jobs. And that's not realistic when we only get paid $7,200 a year. It was not realistic that we could stay out for that period of time. And so we felt like the best was for us to finish up the first special session and then come back and face the reality. We are hoping that there will be a court case that will be successful to keep the maps from being implemented.
I just want to stay for a moment with this idea of what your colleague, Representative Collier, decided to do. What do you make of the fact that she hasn't signed this document? She slept on the floor, and right. She seems determined, last I had heard, not to come out. She's not going to sign it.
Right. Well, you know, and I think that's her right. She's making a point of we aren't children, and we haven't done anything criminally wrong. What a waste of resources. And she's making a point that this is ridiculous. We should not have DPS following us around. So I applaud her in her efforts.
When you left, you said you hoped that there would be enough public pressure to stop this. That's what you told this program. Mm-hmm. And yet you're mm-hmm. back now, and it seems as if it's going ahead. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the governor feels like this won't cause him to lose his reelection. That's what I think. He feels like he has to bend over for Trump because there's more pressure coming from Trump than there is coming from the people of Texas, which is unfortunate. I think it could cause him his reelection in 2026 because people see this as the corruption of our system. You know, again, it's tearing at our democratic values.
You talk about what it means for the system. After our previous conversation with you, we spoke to California Republican Kevin Kiley about the retaliatory effort by Democrats in that state to redraw districts there. Here's some of what he told us.
The sole purpose in terms of how they're going to draw the district lines in California, I mean, they have, the governor has been very clear about this, is to increase the number of seats for his party. And that's wrong. I don't think it's right when either party does it. And it's certainly wrong to return to that system when the voters of our state have overwhelmingly said that they want this to be done in a nonpartisan, independent way.
CNN said the Texas effort has set off a nationwide gerrymandering arms race. Is that what's happening in your country?
Yes, I totally agree with that. And honestly, I agree with the Republicans saying that California shouldn't. However, if Texas is going to fast pass a new map, there should be a response to that. And I think every state should have an independent redistricting commission because, you know, we should not be drawing our districts based on partisanship. We should be basing them on communities of interest, keeping cities and counties whole. We can't have this crazy map that goes all the way from Central Texas to Corpus Christi on the coast.
But do you really think in the federal climate right now in the United States that a new federal law around voting rights is plausible?
No, not right now. No, I don't think it's plausible right now, but I do think that we should continue to promote it and keep working at it.
I guess I wonder, though, you know, one state makes a change, another state makes a change to try to match it. What do you think this says about the state of democracy in the United States? I mean, even if everything evens out, where does it leave the system?
Well, I think it's fragile, and I do think it's unfortunate that California would have to go that length, but they're only doing it in response to our governor trying to redraw the maps to please the president of the United States. You know, we have a fragile democracy. I think that we have had the Voting Rights Act in place for many, many years. We do need federal law. I don't think it's going to happen right now. It will take a different president being in place.
So your only hope right now, though, to your mind, this is going to pass the legislature. It's just about whether or not the courts accept it.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah.
Representative Goodwin, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Vicki Goodwin is a Texas state representative representing House District 47 in Travis County. We reached her in Austin. A hospital in London, Ontario, has been doing a lot of damage control since a report revealed it was the site of cardiac testing that involved surgeries on puppies and euthanizations as well. Since the report was released earlier this month, St. Joseph's Healthcare London has announced it will stop conducting studies on dogs and review its research practices. And last week at a news conference, Premier Doug Ford said he and his team would, quote, start hunting down anyone else doing research on dogs or cats, unquote. Andy Adler's research on dogs is all about veterinary technology. It's non-invasive, but the Carleton University computer engineering professor has shut his lab down anyway. He told the CBC about the role dogs play in his research and why he made the call.
We're using service animals. These are with the full consent of their owners. We'd place our technology on them. We would test to see whether it was producing high-quality data, and the dogs would sit there. Then we would take it off and see whether it was working well or not.
Does it hurt the dogs?
So this is a belt that we're placing around them. It's not something a dog would choose to wear out of enjoyment, but it produces high-quality data, and that data can be used to monitor them during surgery and anesthetic tests. It can give the veterinarians information about their health in order to make choices. So it's slightly uncomfortable.
So then what did you think when you heard that Premier Doug Ford planned to hunt down anybody doing animal testing?
I shut down all my animal testing in Ontario. This is scary. And I'm okay. It's my students. A student who's put years of a thesis into doing this work is now scared to publish it, saying, you know, the Premier has promised to hunt me down. Now what?
So what is it about it that's scary to you and your students?
The wording. A threat like that from anybody would be scary. A threat from the Premier of Ontario to hunt you down is even more scary. I suppose he could mean anything by it. I think that the most realistic understanding is that professional repercussions potentially, professional inconvenience certainly, but I will innovate elsewhere.
Where are you going to go?
Canada has several high-quality vet schools. I have collaborations with most of them. And I was recently talking to a company in China who's very interested in my technology. I mean, the downside for Ontario, of course, is that if, let's say, I develop a product with a company in Beijing, who's going to get the benefit? Who will be selling the product? Who will be making, you know, the innovation agenda of Ontario will certainly be impacted.
Carleton University Professor Andy Adler talking to Andrew Brown, host of London Morning. Nestled in a canyon in Sequoia National Forest in California are the Seven Teacups Waterfalls. As the name suggests, they are picturesque, so they attract lots of hikers and climbers. But despite their dainty name, Seven Teacups can also be treacherous, as Ryan Wardwell of Long Beach, California, learned last week when he got trapped in a dark cave behind a waterfall near a whirlpool called the Toilet Bowl for 2 days. Brad McLean is a sergeant with the Tulare County Sheriff's Office who was there when Mr. Wardwell was rescued. We reached him in Visalia, California.
Brad, how's Ryan doing today?
Ryan is doing good. Last we had heard from his brother that he's doing well and happy to be safe and sound.
As our listeners just heard, the particular area, portion of this Seven Teacups waterfall is known as the Toilet Bowl. Can you describe this space for us?
The Seven Teacups goes down its cascading waterfalls into these holes or bowls, as we call them, and the one that Ryan got stuck in is known as the Toilet Bowl. And the reason for that is there's about a 30-foot waterfall that drops down into this bowl, and because of the hydraulic of the water falling down, it basically makes a swirling movement in the water, just like a toilet bowl would.
Now, from what I've read, Ryan was with some friends, and when they actually got to the waterfall, the friends all decided to turn back, but he had done this before, four times before, and he decided to go ahead with it. How did he get stuck?
He rappelled down to a spot where everyone lands, and he detached from his rope. The problem was there was a lot of slack in his line, so when he detached from his rope and he let go of it, the current from the waterfall in that toilet bowl pushed it away from him across the other side of this pool, which is about 15, 20 feet. And he was basically stuck on this landing, and the landing is a couple rocks basically big enough to sit up out of the water. So he's standing there and he can't reach the rope that he just used to rappel to get there.
What would it have been like to be stuck in that space?
I wouldn't want to imagine, to be quite honest. I mean, he's feet from about a 30-foot waterfall in this hole that might, depending on the time of year, get some sunlight in there, but you're pretty much in the shadows because it's a narrow canyon. It's definitely not a spot where I would want to be or that I'd wish on my worst enemy, to be honest with you.
How do you figure out that he's alive? You're out there, you're looking for him, you've got teams out. What's the first piece of information you have that gets you a sense of where he is?
So in scouting it, I had our plane for the sheriff's office fly that area. And in looking at it, we were able to see a rope on one of the waterfalls, which was the toilet bowl. So when we all got to the Seven Teacups, part of what I had my teams hike in was a drone. One of our team members for Swiftwater and Dive and Search and Rescue, he operates drones for the sheriff's office. He's flying the drone, gets a little bit closer, and Ryan starts moving, which was just a giant relief to all of us because we have a lot of fatalities at the teacups, including the toilet bowl. So our initial reaction when the drone said they saw him was we thought he had died. And within about a minute of the drone kind of going near him, he was able to move. And the operator is saying, hey, he's alive, he's moving. So it was just this moment of just relief and gratitude, like, holy crap, this guy's, he's alive, he's survived. And it's, you know, basically 2 days later.
So then you actually fly a helicopter into the river canyon to get him out. Just walk me through what that entailed.
Once he was up and he was moving around, we could tell that he was mobile because of the location down this waterfall. It's an area hard to get rescue teams to just to begin with. And we had already requested the assistance from the California Highway Patrol, the Fresno Air Operations Unit. So we told the Fresno Highway Patrol that we needed a hoist to be able to get him out. And the reason for that is they were already planning on assisting us, and it would have expedited the time frame in which we could get him out, because it takes us time to get gear and equipment down there, and then we have to get to him, race him out of this bowl, and then hike him either up to the top of the mountain and then hike to where we have our quads at, or we have to swim him across the river, and then it's a 2.5 mile hike out. So my point of looking at it overall was, we have a helicopter, let's basically go down with this hoist, pluck him out of this hole, and take him to a landing zone where we can have medical staff check him out immediately instead of this long, delayed extraction.
And so when you did pluck him out, as you put it, I mean, he'd been in this cave for 2 days. How was he?
He was good. He was happy. He was just super thankful that we were able to get him because he had tried swimming out of that toilet bowl Sunday night. He had tried doing it Monday night, the night before we found him, and he couldn't get out. His plan was he was going to try to do it again, and he told me, he's like, I probably wouldn't have been able to make it. And he's like, honestly, I was in my mind, he's like, I was already mentally preparing myself that I was going to have to spend the night out there again.
You've been involved in many rescue operations at the Seven Teacups over the years. How are you going to remember this one?
This is one of those that is going to stick with me because he was alive after 2 days stuck down in that waterfall is very uncommon. Normally when we get calls up there, one of two outcomes, either they're dead, unfortunately, or they have a serious medical issue and we find them right then and there. I've never had an experience like that where someone's been out there for 2 days in that area and they're still alive. This is a first for me in almost my 20-year career with the sheriff's office.
It's an extraordinary story, Brad. Thank you for walking us through it, and congratulations on finding and saving Ryan.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brad McLean is a sergeant with the Tulare County Sheriff's Office. We reached him in Visalia, California. When you launch a rebrand, there are so many things to consider. Will it refresh your stature with consumers without alienating your fans? Will it appeal to investors? Is it stupid? And is the URL available? So actually, there are only four things to consider. That last one, though, is crucial. Ever wonder why this show's website isn't just asithappens.com? It's because we waited too long and that address got snapped up by the popular chair company, Asit Happens. Enter the code AIH at checkout for 3% off. But this isn't about us. This is about Joe Scarborough and his colleagues.
All right, we have breaking news as it pertains to our network.
He is yelling about the American Cable News Network that, since its inception in July of 1996, has been called MSNBC. For business reasons that I won't go into because they're incomprehensible to the layperson, who is me, that network will no longer be under the NBC umbrella. And yesterday, Mr. Scarborough announced this change.
This morning, a new name for the network by the end of the year. We will become MS Now, which stands for My Source for News, Opinion, and the World. And look, Andrew, they even have a graphic up. I like it.
There it is. Actually, it looks, the new logo.
It looks very sporty.
So MSNBC, which was a combination of MSN and NBC, is becoming MS Now, an acronym for My Source News Opinion World. Sounds like a terrible amusement park. A B-musement park. Yeah, you can cut that part. Well, we don't know how the rebrand will go in the long term, but in the short term, it's a problem. For one thing, everyone is making fun of it. But for another, more embarrassing thing, there's an existing Korean website for motorized snow vehicles, the URL of which is msnow.com, as in M Snow. And that, as you can imagine, is frustrating for the people who wanted msnow.com to mean MS Now. It seems like a pretty major thing to overlook. But I imagine MS Now will make M Snow an offer it can't refuse, and everything will work out in the brand scheme of things.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Catherine Cullen. Take care.